good pump benefits the actor. Well, we benefit to the actor. The benefit to the actor is the sexual conduct. But does it put any other harm, which would not benefit the actor?
And I'm saying, if it benefits the actor, you go, it's okay to inflict the harm? That was my question. Yeah, I know it. That was just weird. Senate Committee on the Judiciary, Tuesday, May 8, 1979, 1 o'clock p.m., room 346. Work session, agenda.
Oh, yeah,
Senate Bill 734, 489, 876, A. N. Gross 237, 812, 777, 807, 815, tape 40, side 1.
Oh, you hear that law again.
Senate Bill 489, we'll pass over that first one because the clean up is not here. 489, Diana, are you in a position to tell us about that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
Senate Bill 489 is the bill put in by, I don't want to blow
this. Isn't that the one you wanted to pass over? No, we passed over the one before, 734.
Oh,
absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Submitted by the Oregon State Employees Association, which would amend Oregon's open meeting law 192.660 to delete current provision in the law which allows labor negotiations to be conducted in executive session either side of the negotiator's request that it be held in executive session. The bill would delete that. At our hearing on the bill, several problems were raised as to the approach to Senate Bill 489, so in particular because it didn't take into consideration the separate process of mediation, mediation being where both sides in a negotiation have reached an impasse and asked the Labor Relations Board to appoint a mediator, or where the Oregon, or where the Labor Relations Board, ERB, Employment Relations Board, decides that there's an impasse and appoints a mediator on its own. And they're concerned that discussions between the mediator and the public body not be opened up. And because the discussions between the mediator and the representative of the employee union would not be open, and so they felt that with comments made at our public hearing that both sides ought to be treated equally with respect to meetings between that entity and a mediator. And I have drafted proposed amendments to Senate Bill 489, which are in your folder, dated yesterday, May 7th, which would take care, I believe, of the problem of mediation. I think it was the committee's consensus at our last hearing that mediation be kept closed because it was not a meeting between the public body and the public employees, but was rather a meeting between the mediator and one side or the other at separate times. There are two different approaches to solving the problem of mediation, as you see. I've got the First Amendment, and then I have an alternative to Amendment Number 1. It's two slightly different approaches. And the other question which the committee asked to have amendments drafted on was the question of whether or not an agent who is bargaining on behalf of the public body, and in most cases where you have a large local government, they will have their personnel officer or assistant personnel officer represent the public body at negotiations with a representative of the public employees union. Right now, because that's not a meeting of the public body, it's not subject in any way to the open meetings law, and they wanted to take care of that problem, where if you're going to open up labor negotiations, you want to be sure that you open up the negotiations between the the agent or representative of the public body and the agent or representative of the employees of the public body. So on page 2 of the amendments, you'll see that new subsection 4 there takes care of that. Labor negotiations held between the public body or any representative or agent thereof, and the employees of the public body or any representative or agent thereof shall be open to the public. And I want to make a slight suggestion on amendment. Just put a period after the word public and delete any special references to representatives of the news media, because they're covered under that phrase, open to the public. And I'm not sure there's any reason to single the newspapers out when you say they are open to the public, period. Now, subsection 5, which appears on page 2 of the amendment, addresses a question, again, on mediation, but where mediation is conducted with both sides present and the mediator there. In other words, sometimes the mediator runs between the two groups and talks separately to them. Sometimes the mediator gets the two groups together. And this subsection 5 is designed to say that when the mediator gets both sides together and all working toward mutual agreement, that that would be a public meeting, where you have both sides present as well as the mediator. And that's what subsection 5 is designed to do. And again, we want to put a period after public and delete the reference to representatives of the news media.
Yep.
And the last amendment, amendment number 3, which appears on page 2, was the amendment which was suggested at our public hearing by Mr. Danielson, in opposition to the bill, felt that public employees ought not to be subject to the negotiations of a public employee union ought not to be subject to open meetings where negotiations between other private labor unions and private employers were not subject to being open to the public, and felt that people ought to be treated fairly. And at your request, Mr. Chairman, I did draft that up. As you see, it would create a new section to be added to our chapter 663. I'm not sure whether we ought to add to 663 or 662. I'll have to check.
Or maybe United States Code.
In other words, we're going to amend Oregon's little NLRA.
No, this is the little NLRB. I understand.
Yeah, which applies to all labor relations in the state.
Intra-state.
And so, like I said, I'm not sure whether it's properly in 663 or 662. Mm. That's a technicality I'm going to have to check out. But basically, we're just going to put a new section in the NLRA to state that notwithstanding any other provision of law, negotiations to establish or modify a collective bargaining agreement shall be open to the public. Shall be open to the public. Again, I think we don't need to.
It makes it applicable to everybody,
all
including private employees, employers. Yeah, I asked Diane to draft that because that's the way I feel. I'm not sure whether it is who gets favored or disfavored with open meetings. I have a feeling that it would usually favor the employees rather than employers and the employers. But I don't think, inasmuch as the Public Employees Negotiating Act, which I supported, and one time or another my vote was critical because there were some were passed by either 16 votes, passed or failed, or one vote margin a time or two. It seems to me, and I think that was designed to extend to public employees the essentially, with very minor exceptions, firemen and policemen, the same benefits or detriments that are available to others who are negotiating for condition. And I don't see why a public employee should have, or a public body should have one standard, and a private employer, a non-government employer, and the employees have another standard. And so the fair way to handle it, it seems to me, is to extend this benefit to all. And we can do it. There's no question about our right to do it.
True.
Yes.
How, maybe I'm missing something here, but would this cover contracts that are governed by the National Labor Relations Act?
No.
Negotiations?
What? That's not, there are certain areas, and I'm not a labor lawyer. And
I'm not either. That's
neither. There are certain, I think, a certain employees and employers that, because of the size of the business and so on, volume and nature, are not covered by the NLRB. And I'm not expert enough to know which ones these are. I suspect if we had a agricultural workers, I suspect
that one. I know that one's exempt.
And that one would probably be covered by our local law.
But so aren't we going to aren't we creating, even when we do this, a very disparate situation of creating consistency within our own law?
We're going to create everything, you know, the federal government, no, of course, we were at a meeting the other day, you and I, a Democratic meeting, where someone was arguing that there was a threat by state employees to seek to involve the National Labor Relations Board. Of course, as you and I know, anybody can file a suit for no reason at all. And I
think you're right, there is no jurisdiction in that case, though, but
But I don't know what the law is, but someone was threatening to file one in the National NLRB. And the way I look at it, I don't see any reason for treating our state employees one way and employees of an intrastate business not covered by the
NLRB
a different way.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to the question, Mr. Chairman, of the merit, basic merits of the bill, or demerits of it.
I personally think that applied equally, that it has merit. I think that the employee is often victimized by the employer, in a sense, but I think he's sometimes victimized by those who are supposed to be representing the employee. And so if we're all out in front of God and everybody, I think that would probably have a cleansing effect. That's my feeling. I think the proposition is good. I think I would favor it on a national basis if I had anything to say about it, which I don't. But certainly in what we can do, maybe we could strike a blow for freedom and open it up. Let everybody see what's going on.
Which Senator Kulongoski was here? This is his bill.
I don't know what the sentiment of the members here. I just
Burby's on 49.
Senator Burby, I don't know. Well, he put it in at the request of the OSEA.
Right.
He has anybody here from OSEA? They don't have anyone here from the OSEA. I just to test the waters, and we may have to renew it later with more members, but it looks like it has any chance of passage. I would move that we adopt the section 3 and 4, that is amendment number 3, probably reviewing the other two, and that would clearly put the question of extending it where applicable or applicable. I don't know. Does anybody know how to pronounce that word?
Applicable.
For
anybody that knows the word can know how you pronounce that word.
Applicable.
Mm. What are the rules about emphasis on syllables?
If you're wrong, emphasis on the wrong syllable, I understand.
I would move that we amend the bill by adding amendment number 3. Let's see how it flows. Does everybody here understand the intent and purpose of the proposed amendment? Were you here, Bob, when I was discussing this?
I heard you.
This broadens it to everybody. I think I'm going to vote against the whole bill, but I will vote for this amendment because I think it's fair. It's fair. Fair is fair.
Right. Well,
I don't regulate these people. I regulate state employee and local municipal employee bargaining.
Well, you do too. If you were here when we voted for the little NLRB center, if you were here as you were, because you've been here almost as long as I have, you voted a couple of times on the little NLRB. And that was adopted in order to extend the benefits to those people in Oregon who are not covered by the NLRB. And we are regulating them, and we have every right to regulate them. And
this is a public meeting law issue. How is it a meeting that of a public?
No, it's not a public meeting law issue, really. This is a labor negotiation issue. I think
this is a
public meeting is just kind of a little tail following along behind the dog.
I heard the testimony.
If I wasn't a lawyer, I'd say it was unconstitutional.
Senator Brown, I have moved that we extend the benefits of this bill to those in Oregon who benefit by our little NLRB. Those businesses that are not in interstate commerce, as defined by the federal law, and who are covered by our little NLRB, would have the same benefits as are being suggested by the open meetings for public employees. So that if my amendment were adopted and the bill were adopted, any negotiation, as defined by us, would be open to the public. My argument was, if it's what's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. I really can't see that there's any valid distinction between a public employee and an employee of General Motors or Weyerhaeuser. Of course, they're not covered. There's some little podunk thing out here. I think that
Agricultural cooperative
or whatever, and we're the only ones involved. It's the state of Oregon establishing the policy. And the proposal would be, if this adopts, the policy is for open meetings. Because that's one of the purposes of strikes, as you surely know. I know this from the small involvement that I had once in strikes, that the public ultimately decides the outcome of most strikes. Most of your got a stranglehold on it, like if you're an electrician, maybe, and you got a stranglehold on the commodity, then maybe the public doesn't. But in most of these strikes, the public decides. The doctors cross the picket line, and half the nurses do, they break the strike. That has to do with public attitude. Has nothing to do with relative economic strength. That's the end result. So, I've made the motion already. What's that?
The move that we set this bill over until 2 o'clock. So we've got somebody who spends 75% of their practice on labor relations in the island. They probably would be here by 2 o'clock.
Then why don't we, without the motion, I'm personally willing to put it off until 2 o'clock, waiting for Senator Tulungoski. That's agreeable with me. We'll lose Senator Fadley, but I think you know.
Well, I would vote against that motion on the theory. No question the sincerity and no question the difficulty of at least one labor dispute that I remember yourself being strongly involved in. No question about either of those things. But if you like this bill, that is a pretty large albatross to hang around in the
I'm four square for high principles.
Okay.
Florida.
Bill is just a tipster.
We could call it the Atu Brute.
Your point being that it goes from public employees to everybody covered by the
The bill's got a lot of enemies now, but have a lot more with that amendment. That's my point.
I will continue the discussion of the bill about 2 o'clock.
I hear what you're saying. For some reason, I have a feeling that the labor negotiation with public employers, when the employer doesn't necessarily have absolute control of his checking account, like it's true, they've got a lot to push on. They'll leave that post because it's a different bill.
Why don't we enforce that? Here. 2 o'clock, we'll come back to it. Okay? Now, 876. Let's see if we can do anything with that. Do the members know that we plan to have work sessions at every available time this week? We're not going to hear any bill, just going to work on various bills. And next Monday, too. And my plan is to try to deal with all bills that we want to deal with that have been heard before we start hearing any more bills.
Putting that committee on the judiciary, I believe that Senator Wires is bill to permit a defendant in criminal case, in a capital case, to argue the propriety of the death penalty.
And we don't have enough to send it out without Senator Smith.
You're not going to get it. You want to
have a bill? Yeah, all right, okay.
We did have a proposed amendment.
237, then the roof.
You can describe my, why don't you read my amendment?
Well, Senator Gardner would add another sentence at the end of the bill to say the defendant may also show a film or videotape of an execution.
A, is it?
Well, we could put my lottery. We could put my lottery ID in too. Well, I'll tell you about that. When we're not, when
the tape isn't ready, when it wouldn't
be ready. What are we going to do now?
Now, 237 Owen Road.
This is a relatively non-controversial one.
Are there any amendments to that?
It's in your folder. I mean the book.
All the amendments in the book?
Oh, it's 237.
Is that the final? Jim, is that the final form? 237A?
Yes.
In gross.
Yes, sir.
No additional amendments?
No.
I've drawn a pencil line around the word shall on line 6. Does that ring any bell? Let's see. Tell us what it does, Jim.
I think it's fairly simple. Provides for the situation in public contracts and construction contracts with federal funds. For the supremacy of federal law when it conflicts with state law, or if there is no provision covering it in state law, then there is provision in federal law, the federal law prevails. There's the supremacy clause, which apparently, in the absence of this clause, some city governments and county governments, state government have had some problems in the construction contract. I have a letter from the legislative committee of the city of Pendleton expressing strong support for this bill. Without getting into the details in the letter, it simply says that we need this.
I suspect that even without this merely clarifies it, codifies what the existing law is. It would be the same without it.
There has been some question about the national plans for state highways.
I suspect that, that they would be following the federal law where it was inconsistent. I move with two pass.
Senator Gardner moves that we send the Senate Bill 237 to the floor to pass as amended. And the minutes will show that the rule which we've adopted earlier and will be a continuing rule of this committee for all bills considered by us today is that when action is taken on any bill, that it automatically has the result of untabling the bill.
Don't you wish you'd have done that, Senator?
Oh, I object to that.
I like that rule, Mr. Chairman.
I object to the rule. As long as we've got a rule, it seems to me the rule, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm open minded on it, but it seems to me that the Senate rule says that a bill is tabled automatically after 14 days. And so on. And then for a committee to adopt a rule that directly countervenes that,
doesn't countervene it.
They vote to pass it out, but it does take it off the table. The function of motion, if you don't go with this one, if the duplication works, if then my vote to pass the bill out, if it does take it off the table, therefore the function is. If this motion is closed, that is combined in one motion, since there are no differences in the number of votes that are participated in the
session. Well, that, I don't have any trouble with the reasoning there, except that if we have the, it seems like as long as we have the rule of the whole Senate, we should have to vote move as part of our motion expressly that we take it off the table. Otherwise, we should do away with the rule that says that it's tabled automatically after 14 days.
We do it every day by unanimous consent. We move all bills from second reading to first reading to second reading. We don't need every bill. We do it by one motion.
Maybe we should move at the beginning of each committee that we work session and move all bills off the table for the pendency of that meeting.
We do that. It's simply a question of
well, there were people down on the floor today waiting for me to wander up tomorrow with, on third reading of the bill that we had moved out of committee.
That's your problem. You're trying to correct the problem, not good news problem.
I'm trying to save time. We had spent enough time in this stupid committee without wasting it on useless motions.
Now we're wasting it.
No. Mr. Chairman, move the.
Let me put it again. Is there any objection to that rule during this committee? That the motion to send out a bill carries with it the motion removing the bill from the table. Hearing none, so ordered. Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. The move has been made that we pass this bill. Clerk will call the roll.
Gardner?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Wyatt?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Motion
carried. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. We want you to stay here.
Oh, thank you, Senator. I had too much fun.
Senator Gardner has related it. So is the book Waiting for Lefty. I never did read it. Here we were waiting for Cool and Costume.
That's right. What's Lefty?
Telephoned his constituents, what else?
Let's go.
Mr. Chairman, I'd raise one point, perhaps too obvious, but it's not in legislative history. Would it be the committee's intent not to affect the present law with respect to contracting? Present law being that you can't change the rules in the middle of the contract, the rules at the beginning of the contract. So we're not authorizing the federal government to change the rules in the middle of the contract. Is that correct?
That's correct, isn't it, members? That's our intent. Okay. All right. Now, are you going to be with us for a little while, Ted, or are you going to have to leave too soon?
I'm going to be here with you until 3 o'clock.
Good.
Now, let's go.
We're going to do this, Bill.
Which one's that?
That's, well...
We don't have enough votes to do this, Bill.
I want to assign the Senator Smith. Will you carry that last bill?
Yes.
All right.
Senator Smith, you're not going to leave.
No, I'm not.
812.
Good. 812.
That's it. Everybody be concerned. Everyone else stay here and enjoy the...
Right.
You know what, really, the rule in this committee that I think that if you really want to get the people here is that whoever is absent gets assigned the responsibility of carrying the bill. I've learned my lesson. You have us all here very quickly.
The only problem is we probably lose half of the bill.
No, I don't think so. I think that there'd be an awful lot of late night studying.
There. 812. Do we have some amendments on 812?
Yeah, there's an amendment that replaces basically the body of that bill that was drafted. Judge, have you looked at that amendment?
No.
Now, Diana, can you explain this to us?
Jim,
can you explain it to us?
Yeah, the two amendments. One is dated May 7, 1979, and that's the really latest amendment. The other is a much simpler amendment and has no date on it. The bill, as printed, provides for a mechanism of mailing a notice of appeal in one instance, that is attributing the date of mailing, for purposes of running the period for appeal, 30-day period. This bill would allow that period to end on the date of mailing in the appeal from the circuit court and civil case to the court of appeal only. That's because this is Chapter 19.
Now, this is which one?
That's the bill itself.
All right.
At the hearing, Senator Crook suggested that there would be some more appropriate language with respect to how you could prove it because of the problems that you encounter when an attorney is up against the wall and is facing a malpractice suit for being late. They might lie by an affidavit and ask me to look into some language.
Who said that?
Senator Crook.
Senator Mahoney is the one who tipped me to this. He said a cynic or skeptic is a man with experience.
So I checked with the post office and found that there is indeed a mechanism for proving what the date of mailing is, and that's what the undated amendment is all about. The dated amendment, May 7, 1979, includes that mechanism that Senator Crook asked me to investigate about, but also expands the coverage of this bill to more than just civil appeals from circuit court. It expands it to civil appeals from district court, which are about 10% of the court of appeals load, according to testimony in this last public hearing. And also includes criminal appeals. Also includes petitions for review from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court and one particular appeal in an Administrative Procedures Act appeal, and that is a contested case, because that goes to the Court of Appeal. It would not include appeal of a rule hearing under the ADA, because that would go to the Circuit Court. So what this does basically is it carves out appeals, distinguishes between appeals that are filed in the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, as opposed to appeals that are filed on a local level. For instance, from the JP Court to a district or a circuit court would not be covered by this. And the non-contested ADA hearing also would not be covered when it goes to the Circuit Court.
Yeah,
this is, I like to make seventh version better, because it's, that way you only have one rule to remember and treat all the appeals the Supreme Court of
Appeals. Okay,
appeal.
Okay. That's the point. If I understand, and I just read through this, it's your intent that all appeals, both from the Circuit Court or from an administrative agency,
yes,
both civil and criminal, well, there'd be no criminal in this case, but to the Court of Appeals would be date of
the
mailing.
The appeal could be, you can still do the old way, you know, if it gets there, physically arrives and the date stamped in by the 30-day period.
So would the attorney be looking at it for a certificate of mailing,
exactly,
on the back sheet?
You have to go to the post office and get it registered or certified, and then they have a deal that they stamp it right on your certified certificate.
And you don't have to have it. Oh,
you say in certified mail. If you use certified mail, you've got to enter it in the post office register, and I presume you'd have to get a certified copy of that register to attach.
Which they'll give you right when you get the thing. This would remove that danger, that problem of an attorney falsifying an affidavit of mail, because it would be the post office that said what the date was.
Right.
Jim, how does the recipient know that it was mailed in timely fashion?
Well, the recipient, you mean the Court of Appeals?
Yes.
It really doesn't know that, and the issue won't come up unless the thing doesn't get there, probably for a long time, unless the other side raises it or through some means the issue is presented.
What do you think? Do you think we should add to the language and provide that the lawyer shall have the responsibility of providing proof of service?
You could put, or proof of, he can put an affidavit of mailing inside that, too, if you want to.
So, what is the mailing?
Just, and in addition to the other thing, in addition to the certified mail.
Do you think that would be better? We'd require the lawyer, he can mail it, but he'd have to send a certification. I've done this to DMV.
I think there ought to be proof filed with the appellate court. And the proof of that filing ought to go in the service copy to the court.
Okay. No problem.
Later on this afternoon, I'd like to run this by the state court administrator's office.
Well, Judge Schwab has looked at this already. His only question was, he suggested that we make the postmark conclusive evidence. That raises the problem of postal meters being tampered with. I think this is a safer approach.
And currently they don't date those, unless you have a meter. Well,
it should, if your meter dates itself, your meter dates.
How about the post office?
The post office doesn't stamp
us, doesn't give you a date of that anymore. It's so large when you can make a special
right. But I think that's a good suggestion, that right along with the notice of appeal be accompanied by a proof of mailing, a certificate or an affidavit of mailing.
Should be an affidavit or certificate. So what do we ordinarily have? Certificate of mailing to which proof is attached. That's the way it probably ought to be done.
Okay. It would be like a proof of service. It would just you know, agreed that a little affidavit, I mailed it on this date, and then superimposed that requirement on top of this thing that in order to come within this rule, they have to have it a stamp by the post office.
I was wondering if you could simply, it might not be mechanically possible to include the proof of service with the mailing. That would be awkward. But I think we could provide that a proof of service must be filed within some period of time.
No, they could do it right with, they could do an affidavit of mailing, just staple it to the back of the notice of appeal, which would say, I state that I mailed it to the, by, you know, certified mail, whatever.
That's in a separate envelope, though, isn't it?
No.
The way it's done is that when I file an administrative agency, which we do a large practice, let me just have a, what you call a proof of service, because I, Theodore Kulongoski, attorney for and such, hereby certify that I deposited this document in the U.S. mail address to, and then you list all the other parties involved in the case, and send it up, and that's it.
It could be the same as the proof of service.
Yes.
It just add another name on the proof of service, which would be the state court administrator.
Well, that's all very well, you can say it, but I'm wondering how you could actually do it.
Well,
in other words, I dropped the envelope into the box.
And you say you deposit it by certified mail, and
you do that now, though.
That's it. I mean, you know, that's one of the interesting, the tenor of the conversation. I understand it, but what bothers me is that, that you're assuming that attorneys are going to falsify the documents. Now, I'm not so naive, not so it's not done, but I hate to operate from the premise that what we're doing is to have a fail-safe system. The problem I have with you walking into the post office closes at 5 o'clock.
Right.
And you're not going to get the stamp.
Well,
the post office is closed. Yeah. And the thing is that if you do it by certified or registered mail, you do have to take the post office for registered mail. If that's what you're going to do, I'm going to suggest to you just have it by registered mail. If, in fact, you want to leave certified mail in there, I think you should not have to have them go down to the post office and have this proof of service or which is an affidavit. Now, if the lawyer's going to lie, and that's what we're worried about.
I don't have any of that qualm. This was simply put in there to address that particular concern that Senator Cook.
I believe this, that anyone whose reputation, especially in $20,000 or $30,000, is on the line, there are, even among lawyers, 5% that are lying. If we deny that, we're kidding
ourselves. We do have some in the, there are two analogous situations. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit has a rule on service of briefs, not petitions or anything else, but just briefs. And there, the date expires on, say, a Monday. Your brief is timely filed if it is postmarked by that date. And that means, just if it's stamped by that date. There is a similarly in the Oregon Department of Revenue, it's conclusive evidence of timely filing for a petition for review, which is what triggers the administrative proceeding, if it's postmarked by that date. And then if you have a private postal meter and there's some doubt in the department's mind about whether it is timely, then they can investigate it. And you have to establish it to their satisfaction it was, and they say they can do that by an affidavit, whatever. So there is precedent for doing it without this safeguard. but I don't really think it matters one way or another. I think it is the bar has endorsed the bill, and I think it's a way of making a little bit more convenient for the attorneys practicing to conduct their business without really creating any hazards to anyone else. This is purely an administrative convenience for the Court of Appeals.
It's giving to a lawyer an opportunity and ease that he doesn't now have.
Right. That's the intent of it. But I don't have any, if Senator Kulongoski wants to take that particular provision out, I don't have any qualms about that either. But I don't really have any particular qualms against the restrictions that the chairman wants to put on.
Well, I would suggest that we add language to this effect at the end, that proof of service shall be filed with the court to that effect.
Proof of mailing?
Proof of mailing shall be filed with the court.
And by proof of mailing, we mean an affidavit of mailing, not a...
Well, it could be either a certification. I'm not sure we need an affidavit. The proof of mailing shall be made by a certificate of... proof of mailing shall be made by certification.
By the attorney.
Yeah, by the attorney. The certification of the attorney.
Okay, proof of mailing
shall be made by... through certification by the attorney, or words to that effect.
Yeah,
maybe
we can work out that.
Grammatically figure out the details.
That's fine. Then have this more restrictive requirement that they also have to get a stamp from the post office if they want to take advantage of this more lenient. What do you think, Senator?
No,
the improvement of.
I'm not quarreling with the ease of procedure, because it is obviously a problem.
We want to extend this to individuals. Actually, with these provisions, we could extend it to individuals just as easily.
How about by the appellant?
By the appellant. Proof of mailing shall be made
through certification by the appellant.
Certification of the appellant. Your eyebrows are lifting, Judge. Since we have this evidence, is there
another? We've got what you're doing is you're substituting for the one clear, demonstrable thing, which is filing.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we know, and I've driven all the way down to the museum in Portland, that is neither to get in on by 5 o'clock, but you're substituting for something which is certain. Is something, substituting something which is subject to argument. Now, it's one thing to have it performed by an attorney who is subject to some control and through the Bar Association.
Okay, I'll back off. Let's just limit
it to the attorney. We've got a raft of pro se people that are showing up now who never get anything filed on time and who do all sorts of bizarre things in handling their affairs. So, bear that in mind as you adjust the ease with which these documents can be filed.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, you still need, Judge, on this one, they still need to have in hand a receipt from the post office.
All right. I understood that perhaps you were modifying.
No, this is overlaid on top of that other one.
You think there'd still be a problem with those people if we allowed them to use it as long as that evidence were there?
There'll still be a problem, but there's a problem anyway. So I think that would solve the problem.
Okay, so we say proof of mailing shall be certified by the appellant, or words to that effect, and filed with the court.
Oh, yeah, certified by the appellant and filed
and
with the court.
We're talking about filed with the court to which the appeal is taken? Yes, it's to which the appeal is taken. Filed with the court to which the appeal is taken.
Yeah.
Okay, that amendment is included in the amendment stated May 7th. Okay?
I thought you were going to restrict the lawyer.
Well, we decided, in talking to Judge Beatty, and hear that since we have the objective proof anyhow, probably there's not going to be any more screw ups that way than if it brings it down personally. Yeah. So they're going to have to do it right. But we're only talking about timeliness, is really all we're talking about. Yeah. So now we're not limiting that to lawyers. If anybody can do and appeal this way.
But everybody will still have to have, in order to take advantage of this more lenient approach, will have to have in hand from the post office a stamp receipt showing that they deposited
it. You have to be able to prove it. And the certification will say it happened, and that's subject to proof.
Right. Yep.
I'm not sure that necessarily, if I were doing it, I think I would attach my registration receipt and be in the file. I don't know how to do it. Okay, that's the suggestion.
For consistency purposes, would you be inclined to change sender as proof to appellant as proof, simply using appellant in the
Sure. That's all right. Any other technical changes? Okay. Senator Gardner moves the amendment. Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Senator Gardner moves the bill out to the floor. Do pass as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Brown?
Aye. Now let's go back to this labor relations bill, 489.
We have, you have somebody in line to change the bill?
Senator Gardner is fine. 489. Now this is the bill, Senator Kulongoski, we got some technical amendments and then a more radical approach to the problem. Radical being coming from the word root in Greek, means getting to the root of the problem. And that proposal is that we extend the benefits of the open meeting to all labor negotiations covered by our little Oregon NLRB. And at the suggestion of Senator Wires, we delay further consideration until you arrive, recognizing that you are the most eminent authority on the question of labor law that we have, at least in the Oregon Senate.
By sweet praise.
What's the amendment at? You should have it in your packet.
49?
Yeah.
And it's number 3. I'm going to 3 first.
Yeah.
Well, that's
one small amendment just for the period of the public and
my argument, Ted, is this. Whatever it may be worth, but all of them, I guess, really are, that it seems to me that there is no plausible reason to apply, as far as I'm concerned, one rule to public employees and another rule to people who are employed by other concerns. I think the original intent of the Public Employees Negotiating Act was to extend to them the benefits or liabilities that are available to people in private employment. And basically, that's what we've done. And so, it seems to me that an argument in favor of opening up negotiations of between a public body and employees of that public body, and opening up negotiations between employees of a private concern and the employer, I don't see how they can be distinguished, because In both cases, the purpose of the open meeting is twofold. One, so that the public can know what's going on and thereby allow public pressure to influence the outcome. And two, so that those who can't personally be there, whether they're shareholders of the corporation or whether they are members of a union that's represented by a negotiator, their right to know what's being said that affects them. And I'm inclined to think that this probably would have a cleansing effect on the process.
Bern, the only thing I would ask you is that let's just assume for the sake of argument that the state must have some basis to taking action against private individuals as opposed to public individuals.
We regulate them now. You see, we're amending a state law that regulates these private individuals. I'm not proposing that we come in on new ground and get into the labor negotiation business when they're not already there. We've already got into that long ago.
I disagree with you because as far as what you're attempting to do now, because what you're proposing is something that's much more far-reaching than regulating an obligation upon an employer to meet with his employees. And I just want you to explain to me that we're standing a challenge, which, as you know, the labor laws of this nation have been challenged many, many times in the court. The court has always had to read some elasticity into the Constitution to be able to find the right of the state to engage in this process. Now, I want to know how far you think you can stretch it in the private sector by now passing a law telling the private employer and his private employees that he shall sit down and make it open to private, open meetings or public meetings in the negotiation process. I have no problem with what your analysis is for the public sector because I think that's clearly the state's prerogative. That's what they decided to do.
I don't think there's any more of a problem there than with the Supreme Court decisions that have allowed picketing on private property. Certainly, arguably, that interfered with the rights of property, taking without due process. But
you're weighing an interest of the state.
That's all this is. Everything
the court has found more compelling, and that's the freedom of speech. Now, I want to know where it is in this one. What's your overwhelming protection or state interest that you're
welfare.
On what basis?
The welfare of the individuals involved in the strike, the public welfare, and the welfare of the individuals that the bargaining be conducted in an open, clean atmosphere.
Vernon, I'm going to tell you that the Lanham Griffin and the 59 Labor Management Disclosure Act has set forth a Bill of Rights that I think that clearly protects all the employees.
Doesn't it protect the people we're talking about
here? Secondly, that the people that you're talking about, as far as trying to protect them, they internally and the courts have always said that the internal procedures for the representation of the employees is a matter that which the unions will, they will leave to the union, such as, an example, whether there's a requirement that you have all the people ratify a collective bargaining agreement. Sure, it's a good proposal, but the court has said that's a decision that the people in that organization have to make for themselves. And what I'm telling you, I guess, is that if the people of the local labor organization in the private sector want open meetings and they want all these rights, all they got to do is amend their bylaws or whatever they're doing.
Well, I'm not talking about union meetings. I'm talking about negotiations.
No, and I'm saying that they can do that for their representatives because the people who do the negotiating are the business agents, and they can say in there, you shall conduct them in this manner.
I don't think
dealing with
under the present state law, I don't believe the representatives of the union have a right to open up the negotiations over the objection of the employer.
They can sit down and if in fact if that's one of the conditions
bargainable.
What's that? Oh, that the bargainable part is that's taken for granted because you can always sit there bargaining about it.
There were ground rules.
No, it's
but can't force. I don't think you're not saying that the union can force the employer to agree to open negotiations.
When you say open it,
it's open word to public.
You mean open it up to the public. If they want to sit there and bargain over that, and the union thinks that's an overwhelming concern of theirs, first of all, I don't think it's a mandatory item of bargaining. I think it's probably permissive on that issue. And if they wanted to sit there and make an issue of it, they could.
I didn't make myself clear. I'm proposing we put this in the law so they have no choice.
Mr. Chairman, I see that you're not convinced of this,
I disagree with it being in sending to the private sector.
I am moved.
You already moved.
I've already moved it. I don't know where Senator Gardner went to.
He went to Boston.
Right here. I'm asking if he can come out.
He's moving the amendment on the private sector.
Oh, yeah. I moved the amendment, to extend it to the private sector as far as we have jurisdiction over them and to the extent it does not conflict with the national NLRB. Okay, clerk will call a roll on that amendment.
Brown?
No.
Gordon?
Aye.
Mondrowski?
No.
Smith?
No.
Wyatt?
No.
Huh?
Aye. Motion failed. Okay. Anybody else have any interest in the other amendments?
Just one on mediation. I'm sorry. You got alternatives to amendment at one.
Which do you suggest, Diana, and give your argument for?
On the first one, what I'm doing there in the first one is adding a new paragraph B to subsection 2 in 192.660. So it would go in just after line 27 on the first page of the printed bill. Now I'm just going to add a new paragraph to say that executive session may be held to participate in mediation to resolve a labor dispute as provided by 243712, where no representative or agent of employee of the public body is present. So that would permit the public body to meet privately with the mediator appointed by the CRB. And the alternative was to sort of...
Where are you, Diane?
We're on the front page of the proposed amendment.
Yeah, I'm dealing with amendment
number one.
The second approach would be just to amend existing paragraph A. You put in a whole new paragraph states that the public body may meet in executive sessions to discuss strategy for labor negotiations or strategy for establishing real property prices or to participate in mediation to resolve a labor dispute as provided by ORS 243 712, where no representative or agent of the employees or the public body is present. The first part of that language on paragraph A, I took from House Bill 2929, which amends this same section, but I understand that the proponents of 2929, whose language this is in the second alternative amendment, actually prefer our first version to add a new paragraph B. And I think that the first version of the amendment is a little cleaner.
Sure.
Yes.
Now, mediation.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand this. The employees would not be covered in any case, right? Their mediation, their conferences with the mediator would not be covered because they're not covered by the public meeting law. That's why you don't need to have a two-way street.
That's right.
Okay.
What we're trying to do is clarify that there won't be any disparity.
Which one does that? Both of them?
Both of them. And I think that the first approach with the new paragraph B is a little cleaner.
You don't have
separates out the issue of mediation.
But you don't have the thing. Have you still made sure that they can discuss strategy?
Well, that's still the existing paragraph A of 192.660 would remain, and it would just say that the public body may hold an executive session to conduct deliberations concerning the authority of persons designated
okay.
by the governing body to carry on labor negotiations.
Yep.
So we're not going to amend A, we're just going to add a new B in that first version.
Anyone have a choice?
I move the first choice,
number one. Senator Brown moves the bill be amended by number one and from number one amendment, the first alternative.
We have a new B and we number B and
number the rest of the line.
Right. Sure.
Okay, that's the motion. Is there any objection? Hearing none is so ordered. Now, that takes care of one. Now down on two. Diana.
All right. Okay, amendment number two is to add a new section to this bill, Senate Bill 489. As you see on page two of the bill, you're just deleting the current provision in the law to exempt labor negotiations from the public meeting law, in other words, to permit them to be held in executive session. We've deleted that, and it was felt that a more positive statement was needed. Instead of just a deletion, we're going to amend 192.630, which is your basic open meeting law, that all meetings of the governing body of a public body shall be open. And if you turn to page two, we're going to add two new subsections to the existing law on public meetings, and we're going to clearly state labor negotiations held between a public body or any representative or agent thereof and employees of the public body or any representative or agent thereof shall be open to the public. This amendment is also designed to take care of the problem, as I mentioned earlier, of negotiations conducted by an agent of the public body. We need to cover that if we're going to make the public policy decision of opening up labor negotiations.
And I'll move those amendments.
I just wanted to clarify what number five was, too. It's just going to say where the mediation takes place, where both sides are present with the mediator, that would also be a public proceeding.
Okay. Everybody understand the amendment?
Just want to, Diana, it does handle the situation where the school board has, as an example, has contracted out the negotiation to an attorney.
That's right.
And the attorney then shows up and negotiates, and even though the school board, none of the public members are there, it would still be open to public
That's right. That's what amendment, or new subsection 4 on page 2 is designed to do by saying agent or representative.
You know, can I ask you a question? Why do you throw in and to representative?
Oh, I'm sorry. I indicated that that's redundant, and you would have said you can say it's open to public period. So, sorry.
That's already amended, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, we've already taken that out.
Yeah.
We've already taken out the news media. Now, you just take and burn, you're only moving 4, not 5.
Okay. Well, yeah, 4 and 5. The whole business here on the proposition 2. Bottom third of page 1, right through the middle of the type on page 2.
Also, and before we leave that, on page 1 of the amendment, down there, third line from the bottom, you'll see a reference or discussing any business underlined. Now, that was from House Bill 2929. I understand the sponsors of 2929 don't have agreed not to have that language, and so I don't see any point in that.
Well, you want to take that out?
Just
I was
going to
ask you about that. That's a major
change. What's that?
Is that third line from the bottom or discussing any business? Instead of deciding and deliberating toward a decision, that means if you get a people together and they talk about anything,
okay,
that would have covered us at lunch today.
And House of 2929, the sponsors of that, have agreed to delete that.
Where did that insertion come from?
It came from 2929.
How did it get from 2929 to here?
Well, 2929 also amends 192.6.
No, I understand that, but how, by what?
She just thought it would be a good idea.
By what magic was it transported?
Yes. Gratuitous from me, and that's what I'm saying.
We'll figure it out. Nobody take it out.
It's out.
I'm having problems with Walt. We moved the First Amendment on the first page. It says to participate in mediation, and the way that reads on your bill that you have, it says that executive session may be held. It says executive sessions may be held. To participate in mediation to resolve a labor dispute is provided by ORS 243.7 where no representative or agent of the employees of the public body is present. And then on the other side, you say,
do I understand that to mean, I understood it, I may be wrong, that's where the mediator is conferring with the employer.
That's
the problem, because when you read 5, it says, which now says, all meetings of a public body, of the governing body of a public body shall be open to the public, and it says, where mediation conducted is provided in ORS 243.7 where both a public body or any representative or agent thereof and the employees of the public body or any representative or agent thereof are present. Shall be open to the public and to representatives of the news media. How the process works, Vern, is the school board being here and the teachers are being there.
That's right.
And you're just running back and forth, and I think it's unclear when you say present. They're all going to be here. They're all going to be present, but they're going to be in different rooms, and I think it's ambiguous as to what you're intending.
How would you clarify it? Really talking about when they're both physically in the same place, face-to-face, talking to each other.
That's not what happened.
Well, if it's not what happened, I don't think they ought to stick their nose in it.
No,
not
with it.
Wouldn't affect them. They're in the
same
room. They're not in
what the problem is that what you're talking about are present. And what the definition is the word are present.
Okay.
I mean, they're going to be present here in these two rooms, but
how about if we say are present for purposes
of together with
meaning? How about if we say present means that they're face to face in one room?
What I'm trying to figure out is if you've got the exception to the executive session, why do you need 5?
It's not an exception to the executive session.
No, I mean it adds it sets forth that provision
which says you can go into executive session.
Right. Well, I agree with you that perhaps five is not completely needed.
I don't know why we need it. Why do we need this at all? I thought we were, when we take out the exception, why do we need to recite the coverage?
Well, I think to clear up any ambiguity and intention of the law.
I don't. Do you think we need it?
No, I think the Walsh Amendment handles the, yeah. I think what you need is you need four after you enunciate four.
Yeah, that's enough.
And then you have the exception, which is Walsh Amendment 1. I don't think you need five there.
Yeah. That's right.
You want to leave it out?
Yeah.
Leave five out.
Okay. All right. So we'll leave five out. So the motion then is to adopt the matter that is referred to at the bottom of page 1 is amendment number 2, only you take out the proposed new language that's not in on the first page, down the fourth line from the bottom, and over on the second page, the portion numbered 5 is not included, and also in number 4, the last words that refer to the news media are not included. Now, those are the things that are not included in the motion. The motion includes everything else.
Sure.
So that's... yes.
Well, I need some discussion really on 4 on the merits, because it seems to me that we had a conflict between two segments of public employees. I think we had fire teachers on one side and the OSBA on the other side.
On the amendment are you talking about, or are you talking about on the bill?
Well, on the bill. But
let's get the amendment taken care of first. Do you have any question about the amendment?
No.
All right, Senator Kulongoski moves the amendment that is included in 2 as I just described it. Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, it's still ordered. Now, does anybody want to move any more amendments or move the bill? Anybody want to move the amendment?
I move the amendment.
Well, the amendments are adopted, excuse me. Aren't they? Yeah, we adopted them.
Yeah.
Well, Walt's leaving now.
Walt
said that he had a question before he voted on it. He just walked out of the damn room.
Does anybody want to move any more amendments, is what I thought I said, or move on the bill?
I move the bill.
You move the bill without any amendment. How do you move it? What do you want
to
do with it?
The floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. We've heard Senator Wyer.
Assuming that it's been taken off the table if it needs to be due to the prior discussion.
Right. Which it was. It is now being taken off as you have go through the motion. All right. That's the motion. Is there any further discussion? Senator Brown, do you want to...
I'm just looking out here from the prayer problem.
I got
this
problem
all come here, that one went away.
Would you like to look at
your
vote
too? I have to...
Other than the amendments that we moved today, are there any other amendments to the bill?
Do you have some perfume to wear
there? I don't know what other amendments to follow the family.
There are no other amendments other than what we've done today.
That's right. That have been proposed either by committee members or anybody else as far as I know.
Okay, are we ready? Clerk will call a roll.
Senator Brown wants to discuss on the merits.
Well, just tell what you want because everyone else is confused. Made up their mind. Yeah, go ahead. Do you want to ask?
Would you like to poll the audience?
No. Guys, could you review the closing constitution? As I recall, the firemen and the teachers were on one side of this, and the OSBA was obviously to push the bill. They liked public bargaining.
You got half and half.
Arsenal.
Like, how many state employees do you have down in your
area? I'm only employed with the bill.
That's the philosophy of it.
I think there's an idea, Mayor Brown, that there was disagreement not only among public employee unions, but also among public employers. So it is not, there's no universal consensus on opening up public employee union bargaining. I would say the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association is supporting the amendment, opening up the
newspaper. Well, they're not always right, as a reminder of the meeting.
Are we all ready? Okay, the clerk will call the roll on passage out.
Brown?
No.
Gardner?
Aye.
Lewandowski?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Wired?
McCullough.
Huh? Aye.
Brooks?
No, motion failed.
Okay.
Still fail. What is
what was the point?
Why do you want to know?
Because it only applies to a public employee.
Fair is not fair.
Fair is not fair. That's
the advice of the
judge.
It's not inconvenient. We can all support it.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, let's see. Senator Kulongoski, we've got.
Yes, sir.
Do we want to talk about 7:34 anymore, or do you have some amendments?
Well, you know, as long as the lobbyists are not going to leave, we should talk about palimony.
7:34.
Is that palimony?
Palimony.
7:34.
You had some amendments.
Mr. Chairman, what I suggested to staff and what I would ask you to do is that take the printed bill and I would propose that amendment be drafted that other than the question of child support, because that's already covered under the existing statute, but as to the other part of the bill as it relates to division of the property and things like that and alimony, that I would like to see drafted that those types of lawsuits would only be brought if in fact that there was a written agreement entered into prior to that time, that the suit filed. Can I do it that way in appropriateness fashion?
You can if you want. I don't think I will support it, for one. But why don't we put it off when you have your amendments ready? Well, we'll bring the bill up.
Do that, please.
And we got a couple some more bills here. I think 777, that's not the Adventist bill, is it?
That's the,
is that the Adventist bill?
No, that's the,
legal aid
bill.
777. 777. We got a little time here. We got about 20 minutes.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
We've got a couple more bills here that we can maybe dispose of. What did we do with 876?
What was that one?
Well, that's the one we
did. Wait a minute, are we having, I thought we had some amendments to 777.
777, do we have any amendments?
Not that I know of.
None that we know of. Now this is the, this is the bill having to do that would prohibit the award of attorney's fees for the contract amount claimed is less than $200.
That's the garden. I don't pay our rent.
Does anybody want to do anything with this bill?
I don't know. What do you think? It's who is on the other side? Are you on the other side of that one, Bob?
Yes.
And you're. And I suppose that
I don't know. I think it's all right, but
does everybody on the committee know what the purpose of it, what problem?
Why don't you review it for us?
Go ahead.
Why don't you both come up and review for us the pros and cons?
Bob. I'd rather just hear from Michael myself.
That's discrimination. I'm Michael Taylor, for the record, legal aid service for Multnomah County. What this bill would keep plaintiffs from bootstrapping themselves in the district court by tacking on attorney fees onto contracts, contractual attorney fees onto contracts that are less than $200. There's a loophole in the law. You can sue someone in district court for $50 plus $200 attorney fees. That puts you over the $200 limit for district court, and you can bootstrap yourself into district court that way, even though what you basically got is a $50 debt. Now, typically what happens is a default judgment ends up getting taken in district court, and a few attorneys get enriched out of the deal. That's what happens. So,
would you accept this bill would you be happy if we provided that this would happen and that we would require, before they could claim the attorney's fees here, that they must give at least 10 days written notice to the debtor, giving that debtor the opportunity to pay it off, and that if the payment is not made within 10 days, that then they shall have the benefit of the contract?
I don't think that would do our clients much good, and the reason is that the reason that these cases get to court in the first place and you lose on a default judgment when you're the defendant is because you're flat busted and you don't have the money. The attorney fees provision operates as a penalty, and people just don't have the money to pay it on a $50 debt. That's why you go to court on a $50 debt. So I'd have to say honestly that I don't think that would do our clients much good. Yes.
I'd like to hear from the State Bar on this particular bill. I think they have an interest in it, too.
Do you have an interest in this, thank you?
Yes, we're opposed to the bill, Mr. Jones.
Why?
Well, we just feel it. We shouldn't.
David said that people could not enter into an agreement between themselves, regardless of the amount, as far as loaning money, when the law still provides. And it isn't the fact that they're going to get the attorney's fees, but that's a lever by which somebody's going to pay it. Why would anybody want to repay $150 or $200 or $100 at all? You just walk away from it. And what's the recourse? Are they going to spend the money to collect that when they can't have their attorney's fees paid? That's all. What you say, I think, is a reasonable thing. What you propose to a 10-day item. Now, I know what legal aid's concerned about, and I can sympathize with that, where commercial lenders are using this. That's one thing, but I don't know. They come up with a figure of that there's a very minor part of society that loans money among themselves on this. This dissuades people to go to their friends to borrow money and sends them into the hands of a commercial institution to borrow money. If you took away this club, this lever whereby their friends can and have their money repaid. Now that's our objection to the bill. I think you come up with a reasonable compromise, a 10-day item. I think that's a fair way of handling it so nobody can take advantage of the situation. Senator Gardner,
go through that 10-day rule.
Well, my proposal would be analogous to the situation where the bodily injury or property damage of a tort claim of less than $1,000. You give a 10-day notice. Under that, the construction of that particular statute, you must give 10 days written notice. And if payment is made within that 10 days, you cannot claim attorney's fees. But if payment isn't made within that 10 days, then you can file, and we're used to alleging, giving of notice, and then at the time of filing, you're entitled to your attorney's fees. You have to file. But if they pay in that 10-day notice, then they don't have to pay any attorney's fees. They deprive you of the attorney's fees.
I think there's a rather substantial
distinction. I saw immediately what the analogy you were thinking of, because I'm quite familiar with that 20.080 talking about. But the big difference I see is that the or 20.080 would get insurance companies that were responsible on claims to pay them when they should.
We're taking something away. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, but the insurance company was using the evil that was being attacked by 20.080 was a management decision. Against the management decision being made that we're just going to deny claims or be very, very stingy about them on the theory that the people won't go hire a lawyer and go through all that. But the insurance company had the money. So what the legal aid is pointing out is that a lot of these people don't have money, and that they can get a default in the small claims court for $50. And then go about collecting it through execute and so on. I'm saying that if we pass this law, people who had a $50 contractual obligation that they hadn't paid, the creditor could go into small claims court without a lawyer, get the default if the guy doesn't have the money or the woman doesn't have the money, and then go collect it. But what they're doing here with somebody who essentially really doesn't have the money is that they're able to load it up, make it more financially worthwhile for a collection company or for a lawyer who wants to specialize in feeding off this element of society that doesn't have money or doesn't pay their debt. You have it is the case by case basis.
Which ones they're going to go hungry?
There are people who have learned how to who run this as a factory proposition and make money on it. In law school we had a guy named Brian O'Brien, who's a friend of mine now, and at the time I was very appalled by what he was doing, and I tried to attack him and all that in class. But now he's helped me since, and I understand his business. But he was told he came. No, I'm not joining him. I'm not about to. I wouldn't want to do it. But he does it, and he does it from my understanding, a fairly high level of ethics. But he came to law school and talked about how he specializes in collecting money, and a lot of it is on small things like your health fraud. They're what they would have called paper producers. They get people in, they sign them up on a contract, they're going to pay it out over a fairly long period of time, knowing that they aren't going to use the service over the whole period of contract, but also knowing that they've got a good contract that they can go and collect on. Now, this is just aimed at the small amount of debts that are under the $200 limit. And you can get a default. You don't have to have a lawyer to get a default for under $200 in the small claims court, which I think is one of the policies of the legislature. We want it, in as much as possible, help people do it themselves without hiring lawyers and not setting up a system that pushes people toward getting a lawyer. But this is the problem that this is addressed to is that the guy can get a default in small claims court without a lawyer, but he chooses to use a lawyer and knock it up to $250. So then when they go into their collection procedures, whether it's garnishment or executing on some personal property, they have more money to collect. And it's still the same guy with the same debt that he has today. I'm for the bill. I've got my name on it.
You
want to
move
to the water?
I'm not sure.
Mr.
Chairman,
the
other thing that just occurs to me is that what are the limits, Diana? What are the limits of our power to tell people that they cannot make contracts?
Oh, we can do that all right.
Are you sure?
For example, we can prevent and have prevented certain default judgments in the state of Washington. Has done it for more years than we have. Deficiency judgments that we believe it goes. We've required, I saw Judge Lent the other day and reminded me of the, he was one of those that supported the bill that I did, requiring where it's written in as here, the debtor is entitled to attorney's fees here if he prevails, whether it's in the contract or not. We've put that in, so it goes both ways now. We did that by statute. I don't think we can go back retroactively, but I think this would affect contracts entered into prospectively.
Sure.
Yes.
Diana, what are the highest attorney fees and court costs you know of that have been awarded for $199?
Let me, before you do, I'll bet that there's a rare day when Elmer defaults that you get much more than 25%. That's what it used to be in most of the courts, although you can find an occasional truly judgment. But on a default, it's usually pretty much by what used to be the fee recommendation. On a trial, it might be something else.
Usually the only exception I've seen is for like fraud or something like this, when it says check fraud, the word actually fraud, not just an NSF check.
Senator Smith, in my testimony, I saw an example of one client, default judgment taken against her for $106 on a note plus $100 attorney fees and another $25 prevailing fee, which is kind of an additional attorney fee plus cost. There's a statement of one of our clients which sued for $168.19, $50 attorney fees. There's another statement of one of our clients, that's Vicki Peck, $45.55 she was sued for, plus, and she was awarded, the plaintiff was awarded in a default action, $25 attorney fees, plus $51 court costs, which included, again, that $25 prevailing fee. So even though it may typically often only say that there's $50 attorney fees, in fact, I mean $25, there's actually often $50 because of the prevailing fee.
Yes,
Chairman, in answer to Senator Gardner's question, I think that lines 12, 13, and 14 do raise an issue, as he stated them, because of the fact the way the section is written. And the reason I raise the issue to you, because it says, beginning on line 12, it says, the court shall not award attorney fees specified in the contract. And what it's doing is saying that two people have contracted to have this provision in the contract. And what you're doing is having the state come in and say, well, we're not going to enforce that particular clause. I'm not arguing that it can't be done, but I think it has to be done basically in an approach that, if you want to do it, is that it's a public policy that we shall not allow our attorney fees in any case in which the amount sued for the contract is less than $200. That way, that I think that what you're doing is you're getting away from this contractual argument that two people have contracted and you're not going to enforce one of the provisions of it.
Okay, does anybody want to make a motion on this? If not, did you make a motion, Senator Wyatt?
I don't want to move now. Well, I think
we need a bull star in here, but I think want to say that I'm interested in pursuing this bill.
You don't want a table. But it's already automatically tabled, probably. Anyway,
it doesn't matter. We take it up again, and it's such a more
right.
So.
I want to look at that question.
Let's go to Senator Wyer's other bill about death penalty, 876. See if he's got the vote
right.
Senator Wyer, here's one for you, 876.
I'm going to need you, sir.
Okay. I have an amendment to that, Senator Wyer. You're going to like this amendment.
The one that's in the folder?
Yeah.
That's two.
It's a color, though. Well, I would have.
Let's see. Notwithstanding any other provision of law in a trial upon an accused or innocent of one or more of the crimes charged and punishable by a sentence of death, and the defendant may argue the propriety of the death penalty to the jury during the defendant's closing argument. Okay, do you move your bill, Senator Wiley?
Okay. Can I move an amendment to it?
All right.
I'd like to move my amendment to it, which is in your folder.
876. Okay, what happened to
him? Let me read the amendment. Quote, the defendant may also show, this is in line 6 of the printed bill, after the period, the defendant may also show a film or videotape of an execution to the jury.
Could Judge Beatty just comment on these?
On
the amendment?
In the amendment?
Do you want to comment on the amendment?
I've never been.
Judge Beatty?
I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
I didn't hear what you said about the bill you just said.
Mr. Chairman, John Beatty, representing the Judicial Conference. I just saw the amendment today. I've already stated to the committee the views of the conference. It's our responsibility as judges to carry out the statute, and I think the proposed amendment is subject to exactly the same objection that I stated to the printed bill. What you are doing, in effect, if I may be at liberty to say, is you are allowing the jury, the argument to be made to the jury, not on the question which the jury is to determine, which is innocence or guilt. You're arguing the issue that was before the people and on which the people voted. And it just seems to me that this makes a travesty out of the whole process that you're calling upon the court to conduct. So I think we would clearly object to that. I think it's improper.
Yes.
It's clear, isn't it, Judge, that a procedure could be designed whereby a jury, would pass upon the propriety of the punishment of death in a particular case.
Correct. Could be.
Could be, and that's, some would argue that would be a more proper procedure. What we have done in this is to, I suppose, compress the two, the adjudication on guilt, and added some element of consideration of the propriety of that particular punishment to that procedure. And you're saying that is an improper melding of function.
Yes.
Jim, you know, I'm coming, from Missouri, that they, obviously Oregon has adopted the procedure that all sentencing is in the judicial decision by the sentencing judge, and the jury plays no role in the sentencing aspect, absent a request by the court on leniency, which I know they have done in Lane County. The judge has actually told the jury. But, in Missouri, they do this very thing.
and in fact the jury is involved in the sentencing aspect, and you, so I don't think there's a constitutional question. I think the question is whether in fact we want to put the nose under the tent as far as what we have generally devised as a statutory scheme for sentencing in the state. And I take it that's what your concern is.
My concern is not with the policy decision, which is A, made by the people and is subject to being reversed by the legislature. My concern is that you're taking an issue which the jury has no function to decide.
Under our system?
Right.
Yes.
Under our system, and inserting it in the trial process, and which I have no doubt would immensely complicate the trial of the case.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to vote against my amendment and the bill. I think if we wanted to do this procedure, the proper way would be to modify the death sentencing procedure rather than to introduce this kind of evidence at the trial of the offense itself.
The other method, of course, would be to initiate another program to eliminate the death sentence.
Well,
go ahead. I think that the only, I'm glad that Senator Gardner doesn't like his own amendment anymore. I think that, so I won't comment on that. But as far as the bill is concerned, along with what Senator Kulongoski said, the fact that we've got a symmetry that this would throw a bit awry is maybe a lesser consideration than the idea of killing people, to me. And the fact that the people in a dispassionate, removed abstract way have gone into the ballot box and voted on a ballot measure to kill people is far different from people, selected from the public, making a personal direct decision to kill somebody. And I'm quite in favor of having that made very dramatically clear to them what it is they're involved in and what some of the arguments for and against it are. And if it breaks up some of the symmetry, or if it begins to change our way of doing it, rather than dumping it onto the judge where the dispassion of the training and experience is all along the line of following the law, and it's not me doing this, I'm just an agent of the people who told me to do it. That's easier, probably, for a highly trained, experienced person to do. Needless to say, that I'm against the death penalty, but I think that we ought to. I'm willing to live with causing some confusion in the symmetry of the court system in order to make it as hard as we can for people to kill somebody. I'll tell you the way I feel about it. I was going to suggest, Jan, that maybe see what you think of this amendment. But on line 5, if you would delete after the word may, the words argue the propriety. On line 6, delete the words of the death penalty to the jury, substitute in their language that would read, advise the jury of the possibility that a sentence of death may be imposed. And then, so it would read, notwithstanding any other provision of law, in a trial upon an accusatory instrument in which one or more of the crimes charged is punishable by a sentence of death, the defendant may advise the jury of the possibility that a sentence of death may be imposed during the defendant's closing argument. Now, it's really more to clarify it, to try to, I'm not at all sure that it would be appropriate to have you making a political argument against the death penalty at that time, because that's a political decision in a sense. But I don't see anything wrong, personally, with allowing the jury to know that one of the consequences of their actions, if they convict this person, is that he may be executed. And I know that's contrary to our tradition, but I don't think this is contrary to the statute. I don't think, for example, that anyone who favors the death penalty could condemn me for allowing this to happen. I think it's consistent with the death penalty.
I think it is, Vern, it is a more administratively, there's an easier way to do it, and I don't think if that's the committee's desire, and I think that I think that you should go to the death penalty statute and draft a jury instruction and just say, in any case which there's going to be a death penalty, the sentence of death may be imposed, that there shall be a jury instruction that the legislature drafts that the court shall give to the jury. Now, I realize that it's still putting the jury in a position knowing what the penalty is going to be, but what that would avoid is many of the politics of the issue. And, you know, having a more persuasive attorney like Mr. Posey argue this issue or make a statement on it than a less experienced attorney, because what you're really after, as I understand it, is to let the jury know that when you're sitting out there deliberating, that this man, if you find him guilty, may be subject to the death penalty. And the way to do it most fairly, if that's going to come about, is to draft this jury instruction and just say the court shall, in any capital case, give the following instruction as part of its jury instruction.
How about a general? The court shall, in any proper case, give an instruction advising the jury of, under the circumstances under which the death penalty may be imposed in the event the defendant is convicted of on a particular count.
You can't do it with, if he's convicted, because you want to get it to him before the jury deliberates.
You want to tell him in the instruction.
That's what
the general instruction. Before the jury.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you know what I mean? Now, I'm going to tell you, I haven't made up my mind on the bill, Mr. Chairman, very truthfully. I think that I want to think about that, but I think if you're going to go that approach, that the approach to use it is in the way we just talked about through an instruction.
Yes.
Why don't we have maybe Senator Ward and Judge Beatty get together and try to come up with an instruction?
Would you be willing to do that, Judge? Pick out an instruction that might be given either before or after the evidence.
Judge, that in no way implies your acquiescence or approval.
Now, I think that's a reasonable approach.
Senator, if I may say, my recollection is that Judge Jones trial, but there was an advance statement that was the jury was instructed by agreement of counsel and the court for approval on the alternatives that were available so that they would understand what the psychiatric jury would be for. But I don't think that doesn't create the problems that I see with the original title.
You mean the instruction?
I'll be happy to.
An instruction would not be
Judge, so I understand. What you're saying is that you do not see the problems with an instruction if we draft it so the court is the one that gives the instruction.
That's correct.
Okay.
Diana?
I just
wanted
to
bring
one other thing to the committee's
attention. On this bill?
Yes. At our public hearing on this bill, there was a proposed amendment to limit this arguing of the death penalty to those cases where there is a lesser included charge or where a lesser included instruction is given by the judge.
John, can you get together with Judge Beatty between now and next Monday so we can act upon this Monday?
Okay.
And I'll need some guidance from the committee at the appropriate time. Don't want to be in time committee right now. It's just, it was mentioned this was my request. And the request of Representative Mason, who hadn't been able to get it introduced tonight, but I see it doesn't say it's a request of anybody.
No, it's just a judiciary
committee. Well, if we want to have, okay, but I just want to clarify the Senate rule. If anybody
well, if they want to find out, I don't know who it was. We acted on it here, and I don't remember. I think you brought it here.
I brought it here. If anyone feels that it wants it, that I should have, we should have it. Somebody's request on.
Oh, wait till somebody complains.
I do.
I like that a lot. Okay, we are adjourned. We'll carry over the bills we didn't get to today to tomorrow.
Yeah, I think that was a good term.